Welcome to Belfast City Vineyard, where we are pursuing formation in the presence of Jesus, community gathered around him, and the impact he empowers us to bring in our families, city, and the world. The following message was given at one of our Sunday services. For more information, visit our website at belfastcityvineyard.com.
In the late 40s and the early 50s in post-war France, there was a massive, massive gap between the rich and the poor. Just a ridiculous gap. And between the haves and the have-nots, there was a structure set up within the kind of parliamentary system where the rich just got ridiculously rich and the poor were left. In Paris specifically, the streets were just lined with homeless, and many who had been and fought in the war and come back to find that there was nothing for them anymore. It got so bad and it was so cold in the winters that at one stage the homeless were literally piling on top of one another to sleep over the vents of the subway, in the hope that a little hot air would come through and at least some of them wouldn't freeze to death. And in the midst of that, there was a member of the French Parliament called Henri Pierre, who was also a priest, the Abbé Henri Pierre. And he began to realize that this wasn't all right, that this government system couldn't continue, that those who didn't have, it wasn't their own fault, and even where it was that those who had to do something. And he began to campaign for a change of the parliamentary system, and at every stage it was blocked and it was cut down and it was overturned. And so he decided, with his other hat on as a priest, which was a beret, he always wore a little beret, he had to do something personally. And so he bought a house on the suburbs of Paris, and he decided that this house would be called Emmaus, and it would be a place for anyone who had nowhere else to go. And he began to welcome the homeless in. He began to welcome the lost and the broken and the hurting. And I'll tell you, just I'm going to read one story. It's of a fellow called Djibouti. He was a former African national who had fought for France in the war all across Europe and all across Africa. And he'd come back. He had walked the streets of Paris for several years, living off charity, living off scraps that he could find, half a day's work here and there. And he reaches the end of himself one night, and he goes to his local priest's house, and the priest says, "I can't help you. There's nothing I can do. There's no room here." And as he closes the door, he says, "Actually, there's a guy. You should go there. Go to Emmaus. He might be able to help." And he arrives there, and it says, now that he had got there, Djibouti felt an immense fatigue. On the point of crossing this unknown threshold, he was more conscious of his tired body than he'd ever been walking the streets of Paris, for that in itself was a form of distraction. But there, at the end of the road in the cold night, he seemed to be beyond life. The silence, the peace, were too much for him. He was rendered onto himself, given back. And he pauses to wait for the priest to return, the abbey. He's off gathering beds and tying them to his car for people that don't have any. This young guy welcomes him in, says, "You can wait there, he'll be back in a bit." The father returns. "Father, we have a guest," said Etienne. "I was sent by," Djibouti started to say, and the abbey stopped him and he looked at him. And the headlights shining on Djibouti's face accentuated his irregular features. His eyes met the abbey's, and he knew he would be accepted into the house. No story, no questions. He looks him in the eye, and in that moment, he knows he's found a home. Unremarkable, uneventful, seemingly unimportant in the suburbs of 1940s Paris. Irreversible in this man's life. He finds a home. He stays there for the rest of his life, helping form something that replicates across the world, and that within a couple of years of this point, causes a political revolution in Paris and in all of France that transforms the lives of millions of homeless and millions of working poor, that reshapes French law, because this one priest refuses to look through people, refuses to look over them, but looks at them and accepts them as they are and welcomes them in. And this morning, as we continue our journey in Luke's account of Jesus' life, we could call the passage that we're going to look at, we could call this talk, the transformative power of unconditional acceptance, which is a bit cumbersome, right? Or we could just call it Friendship 101. And if you grew up in a church or you grew up around a church, you're going to know this story pretty well. If you didn't, that's totally fine. It'll be new for you. It'll be wonderful. But I would just call us to try and look with fresh eyes this morning, to look past the flannel graphs, to look past the things that we've always heard about it, and try to look afresh at Luke 19. So if you have a Bible, feel free to turn there with me. I'm going to read it for us. It'll be up on the screen. Luke 19. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he could not see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people saw this and they began to mutter, "He's gone to be the guest of a sinner." But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I have cheated anyone out of anything, I'll pay back four times the amount." And Jesus said to him, "Today, salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost." And there's so much in this passage, and there's so much that we could look at, but I want to simply ask two questions this morning. Are you a friend of Jesus? And are you a friend like Jesus? Two questions we'll ponder for just a little bit, if you will indulge me. So, Jesus enters Jericho, and this would have been a big deal. Like, he was kind of like the happening rabbi, the happening teacher of the time. Everybody wanted to see him. Even if they disagreed with him, they were kind of like curious, and there was these rumors of miracles, these rumors of lots happening. And so crowds begin to gather, and they begin to kind of just swamp him everywhere he goes. And as he enters into Jericho, it's just to see him. Everybody was out, the great and the good, the religious of the day, those who were kind of skeptical but wanting to catch a glimpse, maybe see a miracle or two. And it's probably ridiculously hard to get around this new rabbi. And then enter stage left, Zacchaeus. In brackets, the crowd should be booing right now. Zacchaeus, it says, was a chief tax collector. He wasn't just a tax collector. He was like the chief of them. And to give you kind of a bit of an overview, Israel at the time was occupied by the Roman Empire. They had decided that they were going to charge the Jews for living in their own country, take their money off them. So as the fishermen would have returned from their day's fishing back into the town of Jericho, and with all their fish over your shoulder, they would have met a tax collector at a booth on the road, and he would have looked at their fish and gone, "Okay, you owe the Romans about 50% of that, so I'm going to take that right now." And the Romans were smart. They didn't get Romans to lift the taxes, they got Jews, they got their own people to do it against them, the hated and despised turncoats of the day. And because they were already hated and because they were unscrupulous, they would have gone, "It's 50% for the Romans, and I'm going to take another 20, just for me, just because I can. You don't like that? I'll take another 10 as well." And they would have stole from their own people. They were hated, they were despised. Again and again and again, throughout the Gospels, when the writers want to portray like the bottom rung of the moral ladder, they use tax collectors. Tax collectors and prostitutes, that's what they say. In their view, in their day, in their culture, this is the bottom rung of the moral ladder. There's no lower. This is someone who's turned against and stealing from their own people just for their own ends. If you work for the civil service or the IRS today, I don't think this still applies today. But it's easy to kind of drift into this, I don't know about you, but like Jesus was this subversive kind of left-wing social, yeah, stick it to the man, I'm going to hang out with the people that nobody else will hang out with. And we're like, yeah, we could get on board with that. I could hang out with some tax collectors, that'd be all right. Yeah. But we got to drill deeper. The comparisons don't directly fit. You've got to pause for a moment, and as you consider culture, consider the society around us, who is on the bottom rung of your moral ladder? Like, we all have one, whether we like to believe it or not. Even you go into prison, even in prisons, there's like a pecking order of like who's worse and who's better than each other. We all have one. Who's on the bottom rung of your moral ladder? As I thought about this week, as I was writing this talk, I started to write examples. And do you know what I realized? I realized that we are part of a community and a culture that welcomes people from every background and every story. And whoever you might think is in the bottom rung of your ladder, there's a chance that they might be in our community right now, either here or on a Friday. And I'm not okay to give examples that might make people feel excluded, so I don't have examples written down. But I'd love you to consider for you, as you stigmatize people, as you judge people like we all do in our minds, who sits at your bottom rung? Who would you least like your children to be influenced by? It's a good question, right? Now, as you picture that person, how would it feel for Jesus to say, that's where I'm going to be. These are my people. This is who I want to be with. To be familiar and friendly with, to be intimately connected with. These are my folks. It's a little less stick it to the man subversive. It's a bit more uncomfortable, right? It's a bit more confusing. If we're honest, it's downright offensive. Jars a little bit. This is where Jesus often is. This is the Jesus that Luke and the other writers of the Gospels tell us about. Not the neat and tidy, middle class, religious behavior affirming Jesus that we've grown up with. This is the Jesus that we're called to love and follow. This is the Jesus that says, who is the person that offends the most? Let's go hang out. It's awkward. So Luke tells us a little more about Zacchaeus, and it's about as subtle as a brick to the face kind of a way. It says he was a very short man. I don't know what you picture in your head when you hear that. I think it's like less Tom Cruise short and probably more Danny DeVito short, right? It's like, he must be pretty seriously short for Luke to mention it. So he's got this little tiny guy. And Luke says he goes, he can't. The picture we get is this tiny little, like almost cartoon guy trying to jump over people's shoulders and not able to see, and right? And so he runs ahead in our flannel graph in Sunday school and climbs a tree that's magically appeared. I'm not convinced that that's what was happening. This guy spends day in, day out, his entire life taking money from people who don't want to give them his money, their money, right? If he's like this pathetic little small weak kind of a guy, how does he do that? He's taking money from, you know, day laborers, from people who are ripped with muscles beyond muscles beyond muscles. And somehow this tiny little man takes the money they don't want to give and he's not really owed off them anyway. He has some unsavory backup. He's got some big friends that kind of weigh in behind his demands. And the truth is, I feel, if he wanted to, Zacchaeus could have paid those guys to muscle his way through the crowd, right? If he can get people's money off them that they don't want to give, he can create a path through a crowd. Or if he's as rich as it says he is, he could have just paid his way through the crowd. I don't think it's just his shortness that puts him in his tree. I would propose that it's shame that puts Zacchaeus in the tree. Shame puts him up the tree. He's acutely aware of who he is and what he's done. He knows what people think about him because they'd have told him to his face on a regular basis. He knows who he is and he knows what he's done. And as he hears the rumors of this Jesus appearing in town, the questions begin to run through his mind. What would people say if I was in the crowd? Like if I'm standing there, what are the crowd going to begin to say to me? You don't belong here. You're not good enough. What are you doing? He wouldn't want to see you. You're a sinner. You're bad people. Get away. He doesn't fit in. He doesn't belong with the good moral people of the day. Or what would his friends say? His unsavory, tax-collecting, partying, wild-living friends. What are you doing going to see that guy? Have you turned all good living on us? You ever hear that? Ever gone to told your work colleagues you went to church on Sunday and then they all of a sudden think, you think you're better than us? It happens in our office all the time. No, it doesn't. You could see those questions begin to rise. If I was seen at that place, would they exclude me as well? Would I suddenly have nowhere to fit in? And I think more than those two questions combined, maybe the scariest of all, is what if this rabbi seen me? This moral, religious teacher. What if he saw me in the crowd, a tax collector? Like, surely he would publicly rebuke me. Surely he would tear me to shreds in front of everyone else. What if he actually is the Messiah that everybody says he is? What if he actually is coming to restore Israel, to give the power back to Israel? Me, who sided with the occupiers, I'm not going to be too popular. And shame, that overwhelming sense of I don't belong here, I think, along with his shortness, puts him in a tree. Shame doesn't just say that we've done something wrong or many somethings wrong, but that there's something wrong with us. That at the core of who we are, there's something that makes us unacceptable to others, unlovable by anybody, and probably, if they really knew us, unwanted and unwelcome. You ever feel like that? You ever feel like if anybody really knew who I was and what I'd done and what I thought this morning, they'd kick me out of this room right now? You don't have to nod, because I know it's true. We've all felt like that. That's shame. That's shame. It's not guilt. Guilt says I did something wrong. Shame says I am wrong. I am broken at the core. And we might not all this morning feel like we can resonate with being on the bottom rung of the moral ladder. Some of you might, and that's okay. You're welcome in this place. But we can certainly all understand what it feels like to be convinced that we're broken or shameful or somehow just wrong on the inside. You ever felt like just everything you say is probably going to be wrong? Terrified that everything you built your life on is wrong? It's just kind of hardwired into us that we're pretty sure we're broken at the core. That's shame. Shame says you aren't right. You're wrong at the core. And generally, I find that we have two responses to that when we feel that way. Either we try to prove that that feeling is wrong, and we try to pose and posture and perform and be good enough. And if you were with us 2 weeks ago, we looked at just the story before this, in Luke's gospel of the rich young ruler who comes to Jesus. You remember this? Just nod, it'll make me feel better about myself. If you didn't get it and you were on holidays, check out the podcast. And that's exactly what he does. He puts on this front and he tries to perform and he tries to be good enough and he comes to Jesus to kind of get a rubber stamp on his good life. Many of us, that's how we respond to shame. We put on a front and we try to be better and we try to make people like us and we try to be who we think will be accepted. And we try to earn respect from others around us by money or by status and fame or by whatever means. Posture and we pose and we perform. Or for another group of us, when we feel shame, we hide. We withdraw from those that we think are going to judge us, think that we'll expose our brokenness. We just pull ourselves away. We avoid crowds at all costs or try to find trees that we can hide in the midst of crowds. If I'm really honest, this is mostly why I think people don't come to church. They feel judged and exposed by those who choose option one, the performing and looking good and pretending like it's all sorted. And then you walk into that crowd where everybody's posturing and posing and you go, wow, I'm even more broken than I thought I was. Shame hits and I want to hide and I want to run away. Maybe you're feeling that right now. Let me just put you as much ease as I can. Number one, you're welcome here. Number two, as far as I can have any say over it, no one's judging you. No one's going to make you stand up and call out your sin. I don't know if that's ever happened in any church. If it has, I'm sorry. No one's going to make you tell us your bad bits and put you on the spot. Just breathe. You're welcome here. You're welcome here. Which way do you tend? When those feelings of I'm not good enough, I'm kind of broken on the inside, I'm wrong. What way do you tend? Do you go, I'll deal with that. I'll be better. I'll be better, let's go, go team? Or do you withdraw and hide and pull yourself away from people and avoid? Neither of them are really a great response. But I think that's where Zacchaeus is. He's covered by shame. He's covered by being the wrong person. And he hides in the tree. And I think he's got a mixed bag of emotions up there. He's kind of half hoping that no one's going to look up at him and catch him. Like, in the culture, for a man to climb a tree, a semi-grown man, to climb a tree, like, that is so undignified. Like, it's just unheard of. And he's half hoping, nobody see me, nobody look up, no bird fly out of the tree as people pass by so that everybody's eyes are drawn. He's just hoping he can hide, undignified, unaccepted, unlovable, in a tree, and see this procession pass without event. But at the same time, the fact that he's there tells us that he's half hoping to see something of this rabbi, this Jesus. He's half hoping that maybe it's true, and maybe, just maybe, he might find a glimpse of what he's been looking for all his life. In a room this size, I would bet a lot that there's some people here, and this morning is your tree. You're half hoping that I would hurry up and shut up so that you could slip out the door with nobody speaking to you, unnoticed and unseen. But there's a part of you that's also hoping that you might find something here that makes sense of your life. Sense of that longing on the inside that never seems to be quite fulfilled. And you're in that tension point of, I'm hoping to be unseen, and I'm also hoping to be fully seen for the first time. That's an awkward place to be. If you're in that place right now, you're in good company. We've all been there in moments. We've all been there, maybe even in this place. I think this is exactly where we find Zacchaeus, in this half hoping for life change, half hoping for anonymity. You're in good company if that's you this morning. And look what happens next. Jesus stops and he looks up and he calls him by his name. You ever notice that? Like, we know that Luke knows his name because he's written down the story. But Jesus calls him by his name. And I wonder if it hasn't been a long time since anyone used his name with tenderness and love. I wonder if it's been a long time since anybody used his actual name and didn't just call him a swear word or spit at him. Jesus calls him by his name. He gives him his identity back, his dignity back. And you'd think Jesus would tear him apart, right? This guy is very clearly a broken, immoral scoundrel. And Jesus has him pinned up a tree. Like, he can't go anywhere. He couldn't get away from it. But Jesus' response couldn't be more the opposite. It's a tender invitation into an intimate encounter. It's the unconditional acceptance of a friend. It's no judgment, no harsh rebuke. It's a warm embrace and a powerful invitation. We miss the significance of Jesus saying, I want to come to your house, and I can't go into the bylaws of Jewish culture of the day, but you need to understand, this is scandalous. A meal was a profoundly intimate act. It was a deeply significant act. To break bread with someone, to sit across a table from someone, was to say, we're going to be on an even keel. You and I, we are one. Let's talk together as one. Let's be connected as one. That's why when we break bread together at communion, it's supposed to be so powerful, because we come as one on an even keel before the cross. And it's the same in Jewish culture. This was a profoundly scandalous act. This was an intimate encounter. This would probably have caused Zacchaeus to fall out of the tree had he not climbed down, for it's from the shock of Jesus calling him by name and saying, I want to eat with you. I want to dine with you. I want to be that close. Shame puts him in the tree. But tenderness and love and unconditional acceptance bring him down. And if Jesus were to stand in front of you right now, what do you imagine he would say? Suspend belief for just a second. Go with me. Imagine Jesus were to stand amongst us right now. and to look you in the eye, what would he say? How do you imagine he would look at you? Whatever you believe to be true running through your head right now, all the sins that you think he would begin to point out and all the ways he'd begin to tell you you were broken, I believe wholeheartedly that there would be only tenderness, only delight, that he would look at you with unconditional acceptance. There's a Jesuit priest called Anthony de Mello, and he says this, and it just destroys me every time I read it. Behold the one beholding you and smiling. That every time I get to that place where my life is so chaotic and I realize it's been a while since I paused and looked to God, that as I turn my focus, as I turn my attention back to him, he's already gazing wholeheartedly at me. Not in judgment and condemnation, not with a foot tap and a watch and, hey, where you been? It's been a day or a week or 10 years, whatever. He's not doing that. He's looking with delight, tenderness and acceptance, a deep invitation into intimacy. And within these brief couple of chapters, Luke gives us the two ends of the spectrum of how we carry our shame, posture and pose and try to earn goodness like the rich young ruler, or withdraw and hide like Zacchaeus. And on the surface, if we're really honest, if we zoomed back, it looks like the rich young ruler from a couple of weeks ago is in a much better position. He's been trying really hard. He's morally upright. He's well respected. He is a pillar of the community. He looks like he's in pole position. And Zacchaeus is bottom rung, moral ladder, up a tree. Just up a tree is enough to be like, you're probably behind in this race. But both encounter Jesus. And both, the Gospels tell us, both are loved by Jesus. But only one, as far as we know, is profoundly changed. The rich young ruler goes away sad. And Jesus explains how hard it is to lay down our idols. But Zacchaeus is radically transformed. The rabbis in the day, the more radical Jewish teachers of the day, and there'd be lots of them, would have said, you know, if you've been living an immoral and a sinful life, you know, 20% is probably what you should give away to the poor. You know, that would have been a pretty kind of high bar for the teachers of the day. And Zacchaeus goes straight away, I'm giving 50% of everything I have straight to the poor. And the high bar teachers of the day would say, if you stole from somebody and you want to make it right, you got to pay back what you owe them and you got to give them an extra fifth. That was kind of like stretching it. They would have been the radicals. Give an extra fifth on top of what you stole. Zacchaeus is like, forget that. I'm giving back four times as much as I took from anybody that I took it from. And he's not trying to impress Jesus. This is not what Jesus would have told him to do. The radical was 20%. The radical was a fifth extra. He blows that apart. Not because Jesus over the dinner went, Zacchaeus, we need to sort this thing out. Give away half your... It's not that. He's encountered acceptance. He's encountered love. He's encountered the tender mercy of Jesus. And nothing that held any weight for him holds weight anymore. He can't, like, he's stumbling over himself to give it away. It's a total heart reversal. The rich young ruler goes away sad. And Jesus declares, today salvation has come to this house. Today something radical has transformed. So what's the difference? I think it's this. The rich young ruler believes in God. He spent his life trying to be good enough, trying to perform religiously. He knows a lot about God. But knowledge and belief are not the same as encounter. They're not the same as friendship with. He believes a lot about God, but he doesn't have a friendship with him. Zacchaeus is morally bankrupt. He's like undone. He's got nothing to offer. But in this empty-handed approach, nothing of any value to offer as to his goodness, he's free to receive Jesus' embrace. He's free to experience true friendship, that unconditional acceptance that satisfies the longing in the depths of all human hearts. We all long to be seen and to be known and to be loved just as we are. Jesus doesn't love Zacchaeus more than he loved the rich young ruler. That is not true. Zacchaeus is simply able to receive that love. And as I prayed about this message, I felt that same question again and again reverberate around my mind. Are we friends of Jesus, or do we just believe in him? Are we friends of Jesus, or do we just know a bunch of stuff about him? James writes that even the demons believe and shudder. So belief isn't enough. I was conditioned most of my life to believe in Jesus, to know all about him. And yet I somehow missed out on his friendship. I missed out on his acceptance of me as I am, broken bits and all. His delight as he looks upon me. And when I encountered that, everything changed. Everything changed. You can know all you like about God. You can believe in God. You can believe in the Bible and know it inside out and back to front. Are you a friend of Jesus? Do you know him? Just this week in our Friday community, a young man walked in for the first time. We have a church service on a Friday called Friday Church. Really catchy name. Young man walked in. I will hide his identity as best I can. But he was from somewhere over in the Middle East, from a different faith background. The first time he'd been with us, somebody, a friend, had said he should call by. He wanted to start volunteering with us, but was open to staying and joining us for church. And he came up afterwards for prayer, and he talked to one of our team. And he basically began to articulate that I know, I have books upon books about this Jesus. I've read about him. But books are nothing compared to what I felt today. That as you talked, as you sang, I felt something in my heart. I need to know this Jesus. I need to know more about him. Can someone please tell me who he is? Belief and encounter are not the same thing. Knowledge and friendship are very, very different. Jesus didn't call us to be moral, superior, religious scholars. He didn't call us to be the sin police. He didn't call us to be his defense attorneys. He didn't call us to be mini messiahs that could save everybody. He invited us to be his friends. John 15:15, I no longer call you servants because a servant doesn't know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends. I've called you friends. Are you a friend of Jesus? If you don't know how to start with that, if you don't know what that looks like, if you've grown up with a mindset that's simply about information and belief and performance, you're in good company. Many of us have been here. We'd love to help you become a friend of Jesus. Begin to get to know him. Start like any other friendship. Take time with him. Take time with him. Talk to him and listen for a response. Take 5 minutes in silence every day and say, Jesus, I'm trusting that you are coming close. And just wait. And it might take a week, it might take 2 weeks before you feel like anything's shifting, but trust me, he's at work. As they kick off here again in a little bit, get in a life group with others who know how to be a friend of Jesus. We've got a course coming that's kicking off in September that's just about this. How do I follow Jesus well? How do I be close to Jesus? The nuts and bolts of being in friendship with him. Sign up for that. And I challenge us all, if your interactions with Jesus, your time spent with him, don't leave you changed, don't leave something different, then I suggest that we might want to evaluate, is it belief more than friendship? Are we really connecting with him in ways that shape and change us? I need to really move. We need to be friends of Jesus. Are you a friend of Jesus? But then secondly, are you a friend like Jesus? I'm going to give you lots of bullet points and you can ponder them at home. How's that? Jesus was interruptible. He was utterly interruptible. I think sometimes we read the Gospels and we think like Jesus woke up that morning, had his quiet time with the Father. The Father said, on the third sycamore tree, halfway through the town, there will be a very short man. This is his name. Tell him these things and his life will change. I don't think it worked that way. Luke tells us that Jesus was passing through Jericho. He wasn't planning to stay. He was on his way. He was actually on his way to Jerusalem to die. He knew he was going. That would probably consume your mind a little bit, right? You might be a little preoccupied, but he was fully present and he was fully responsive to what the Father was doing. And as he walks along the street, something in his spirit, I'd imagine, just nudges, hey, look up, look up, look up. And he responds. He responds as the Spirit leads him. He responds as the Father says, I'm at work right here, right now. Will you be interruptible? Are we interruptible? Do we have so many well-laid plans rolling out from now until Christmas? Yes, said Christmas. That we have zero space to be interruptible. Do we walk with such purpose and such focus through the streets of our town that we actually don't see those who God is calling us to be connecting with in the doorways beside us? Have you any idea what the state of mind of your colleague at the desk beside you was this week? Or were you just locked in on what you had to do? How was your spouse this morning as you rushed to get out of the house? Or were we just focused on what we were doing? We need to be interruptible. Do we have space in our lives for people? You can love people all you like till the cows come home. If you have no space in your life, they will not feel loved. If you can't say, yeah, you could actually come sit around my dinner table together. I could actually have a night where we could do that. People won't feel loved. We need space in our lives. We need to be interruptible. What I love about Jesus is he was around people. This is a radical thought. Friendship requires at least one other person. Some of us are like the best friends in the world, but we don't have any other people. Just me and me, and I'm really good at it. Friendship needs someone else. Jesus constantly allows himself to be around people. The gospel writers even tell us, like, he is exhausted, he is spent, he is done, and yet as more people come, he digs deep. And yeah, he takes time to rest on his own, and yeah, he takes time to be with the Father and to withdraw, and he has healthy boundaries, and those things are great. But he places himself constantly day in, day out around people. It's really hard to practice friendship on a cave or in a cave on your own. If you want to meet your neighbors, they aren't in your living room watching box sets. If you want to meet your colleagues, they aren't in your office eating lunch alone with you. If you want to meet the lonely and the broken and the marginalized in our city, they aren't in the midst of your conversations or your friendship circles. They are on the margins, on the edges, longing for an invitation to come in. And if that seems like too risky, and you need a help with that, we currently have a partnership at Storehouse with the Health and Social Trust, the department there that does the medicals for every asylum seeker that comes into Belfast. And pretty much every one of them they send to us for practical aid and for community. The government sends pretty much every asylum seeker that arrives in Belfast, which is pretty much our country, through the doors of our building. I wasn't disregarding the rest of Northern Ireland, just so you know. Just most of the ports arrive here. Before I get angry emails, don't email me. They're here. They're being sent to us. Those who are desperate for community, desperate for someone to talk to, desperate for a connection. They're being sent through our doors week in, week out. We had almost 70 at a breakfast on Wednesday morning that was purely about connecting in community. We need help. Come help us. Come be part of that community. Don't come to fix. Don't come to serve. Come with eyes like the Abbe Pierre, and I think like Jesus, to simply accept, to offer friendship. You'll be transformed, and we'll see lives transformed. Be around people. Jesus initiated. He stops and he calls Zacchaeus down. We got to take some risks, people. We got to take some risks. You can walk up to people and try to start a conversation and they might be mad at you. You can try to welcome somebody here on a Sunday morning and they might have been here longer than you and take offense. So that's the one reason you all tell me you don't speak to anybody new. But what if they're not new? Who cares? What if they are? And your hello, good morning, here's the toilets and here's the coffee actually makes it possible for them to come back and encounter Jesus. Like, our hope has to outweigh our hesitation. The hope of the life that we have in Jesus has to outweigh the fears and the uncertainties, and we have to initiate actually engaging with people. And lastly, what I see in Jesus is he's non-judgmental. This is where I might get the emails. Stay with me for a second. The crowd begin to mutter and complain and despise. They're like, you are sitting with the morally broken. You are sitting with the worst of the day. You are saying he's fine. You're saying because you dine with him that he's acceptable as he is. It's not what Jesus is saying at all. Zacchaeus' past behavior is still sin. Jesus does care about his behavior, but he cares more about him. And he really doesn't care what the people around him are saying, because he knows his heart. He knows that he loves this man as he is, and he knows that in the loving, transformation comes. Accepting people doesn't mean that we condone their lifestyles, but it's in tenderness and acceptance that we find the reason and the courage to face the dark parts of ourselves and begin to change. It's in the places where I know I'm loved that I feel the most free to peel back the layers and go, well, let's look at what's really underneath. And healing and transformation come. Accepting and loving someone as they are might not ever see them become who you hope they might be. That's up to them. You can't fix people and you can't change people. But I guarantee you this, judging them and holding them at a distance will always prevent any form of change. When we exclude people, when we push them away, we guarantee that transformation can come. When we accept and love people, we create the kind of spaces where people can encounter Jesus and encounter change. I gotta stop. Are you a friend of Jesus, or do you just believe in him? Are you a friend like Jesus? I want to be part of that community. That's our hope and our dream for this place. People who know Jesus and are transformed by him to impact the world around us. Why don't you guys stand? I'm going to pray for us and close us up. There's tea and coffee and good things to eat. If you could do me a favor so I don't get shouted at, would you run really fast and collect your children and then come back for prayer or tea and coffee whenever I close? I had a sense as I was praying this morning that there's somebody here. You have a medical condition in your heart, not metaphorically, physically, something to do with your valves. And I had a sense that God might want to heal that this morning. So if that's you, I'd love a chance to pray for you. And our prayer ministry team are going to come right now. And if you are realizing this morning that you've got a lot of head knowledge, that you've been doing your best to be a good Christian for a long time, I'm not putting that down. I admire that. But I would invite you this morning to encounter Jesus. Encounter his friendship. Encounter his delight. Let us pray for you. Let us stand with you and welcome him to come close. If you've never begun to follow Jesus because you're pretty sure he wouldn't want you and you're pretty sure he would tear you apart in the first conversation, if you're hiding in the tree praying, I would stop right now. I just invite you today to find what you're really looking for. Find life and hope in Jesus. I'm going to pray a prayer, and if you would like to begin to follow Jesus today from that place of hiding and uncertainty, then you can just echo this prayer in your heart. Jesus, I thank you that you love me. I thank you that you know the broken parts of my life. You know the questions I have and the doubts and the uncertainties. But today, Jesus, I choose to receive your forgiveness. I choose to receive your friendship. I choose to believe that you accept me and delight in me as I am. I surrender my life to you. Come, be my king. Amen.
Thanks for listening to this message. For all the latest information about what's happening in the life of our church, or if you have any questions or comments, head over to BelfastCityVineyard.com.